It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Part 2 and the conclusion of Saving the Tiger King Cats. I'm Chris Gotzik, and this is Chasing Evil. In Part 1, we learned that prior to going to prison for 21 years for his role in a murder-for-hire plot, Joe Exotic, a.k.a. the Tiger King, gave his animals to his close associate, Jeff Lowe. Jeff and his wife, Lauren, intended to open a zoo in Oklahoma. However, they failed multiple inspections by the USDA, who would have to certify that the zoo met certain basic standards. At one inspection, the USDA stopped midway to order Jeff Lowe to get one of the big cats to a veterinarian immediately. Malnutrition, overcrowding, lack of appropriate vet care were just some of the problems noted by the USDA. So concerned was the government that the Department of Justice's Endangered Species Act attorney began a hard-fought legal battle to get all the big cats away from Jeff and Lauren Lowe. Eventually, DOJ prevailed, and preparations got underway for a massive rescue operation. DOJ didn't trust the Lowes, so they split the operation up into two rescues. The first would be to go into the facility and get the mothers and their cubs as soon as possible. The second would be to take the other approximately 65 big cats. Well, the first operation didn't go as planned. We'll pick up the conversation with our guests discussing their concern for their safety. With me is Pat Craig, Executive Director of the Wild Animal Sanctuary, Dr. Valerie Johnson, the head vet at the sanctuary, Mary Hollingsworth from the Department of Justice, as well as Jenny Crane and Sean Sherab from the Marshal Service.
The Lowes become extremely verbally abusive,
right,
both to the agents as well as Pat's team.
At Valerie and Pat, you were there on the day. How did the Lowes strike you in the beginning? And they didn't know you guys were going to show up. And then as the day progressed, did it get worse? Were they belligerent right off the bat?
Yeah, they were extremely upset, very upset, and yelling and screaming and walking around and trying to intervene with everybody and create more pandemonium than anything. And very verbally abusive, of course, and threatening people and doing all sorts of stuff.
I mean, they threatened to kill you.
Yeah. No, they threatened to kill us as well as officials.
And how often has that happened to you in the past?
Well, unfortunately,
more than once.
Quite a bit, but but still, these guys are, you know, associated with Joe Exotic, and every one of these people carry guns, and so it's a little more threatening when you're talking with people that are armed.
Did you take that threat seriously?
Yeah, to a certain degree, for sure. You know, I kept telling everybody, you know, hopefully he'll just shoot me and not everybody else, and he'll be okay.
As Pat said, they were extremely aggressive from the get-go. They were screaming obscenities at the officials who were trying to keep them out of the way as we transported animals. They were trying to get the animals agitated as we loaded them. So we try our very best to load them with just into the transfer cage using food as an incentive. And quite often they can go right in to avoid sedating animals who are very malnourished and could be pregnant at this juncture. And so while we were trying to get them into the transfer cages to get them loaded, they were screaming at the animals, "Don't go in there," and, you know, just screaming at all of us, yelling at the cats, doing the best that they could to get the cats riled up so that they wouldn't go into the transfer cages,
right,
and to just get in our way. And they were trying to film it the whole time and talking. And it was
So some of this may have been a little performative for
Sure.
Documentary. Okay. So how did you feel though? I mean, this is not an environment that you're in often. Were you worried for your safety?
I was worried for my safety. I will say that many rescue situations are like this. I mean, they certainly took it to a new level, but we often go in knowing that these people might want to kill us and might have no compunction about doing so. And quite often they are very aggressive. They're losing their animals. So it's not uncommon, but these people were certainly particularly concerning. Me and Pat and the whole team are very used to not responding and just ignoring it and trying to do our job.
Right. But they leveled up.
Oh, yeah. They tried their best to wreak havoc. And they even sent drones over to try and film us as we were doing it. And the drones, of course, were disturbing to the cats. And they did everything they possibly could to make it difficult for us.
That leads us to Normandy. Sean, you get a call out of the blue from Jenny. It's kind of, you had described it to me a little bit nonchalant.
Yeah, Jenny and I go way back and we've worked some major operations together. We have a wonderful working relationship. And Jenny called me and she said, hey, I'll be in Oklahoma in the next few weeks and I'm going to see some big cats. And I said, what are you talking about? And I said, kind of laughed. And she explained it to me. She said, have you ever seen the Tiger King show? And I said, I've seen it on advertisements and I decided not to watch it. And she said, you might want to watch it. And we're kind of laughing back and forth. And Jenny mentioned, well, yeah, we're just going to come down there. Maybe we can meet up and say hey to each other. I said, Jenny, give me a second. So I Googled it. I said, oh, no. Jenny, this needs to be a lot more on the operational side, the way the Marshal Service is divided up, the administrative side, operational side of the people who carry the badges, the guns, the arrest authority. And Jenny's on the administrative side. I said, you need me and a lot of other deputies to be going with you. And that's where the conversation started and didn't go downhill at all because of our great relationship. And I told her, you're going to need a lot of help from the people that carry guns.
In my defense, I did believe we would have other law enforcement there, but I knew that I needed to get the home team involved. And that's where Sean's expertise came in.
Yeah, but initially you were thinking maybe Sean and I can catch a dinner.
That's not exactly true.
Okay. And Sean, you have a background in naval intelligence.
Right.
And you've been with the Marshal Service for 20 years. So you had kind of thought about this as a bit of a military operation.
Yeah.
This was a big deal.
Right. That, and I'd also been in law enforcement for 8 years in Oklahoma prior to the Marshal Service. So I've been, at that point, I've been in Oklahoma law enforcement on and off for over 25 years.
Right.
And I knew that this is going to be a really big deal for several reasons.
Tell me about your plan that you came up with and the assets that you kind of called into play.
Actually, I will say the Marshal Service, I had a great career, and this is just another part of it where everything I asked for, I was able to get. I asked for support from the air wing, which I wanted some flyovers to get some better photographs and get a better idea of what we're going to be dealing with. I asked for support from our special operations group, which is basically state and local levels would call a SWAT team. And I also asked for some enhanced abilities with communications and got everything I asked for and then some.
Why did you think you were going to need a SWAT team?
Well, several reasons. So one of the things is I decided to go ahead and watch the show and burned up a lot of brain cells watching it, but I watched it. And during these episodes, I noticed these people on the original Tiger King show were out shooting assault rifles. A lot of them seemed to be semi-automatic. And then a lot of them also seemed to be automatic rifles. They were throwing explosives and Molotov cocktails. There was a lot of talk of violence, a lot of threats of violence. And we did not want to get into a situation where I remember in one of the episodes, Maldonado, also known as Joe Exotic, said something to the effect that if anybody comes to take his cat, it's going to be another Waco. And that really alarmed me.
And you did not even know about the rough road that happened on May 6th. Your operation is going to be May 17th. And you were unaware of what was going on May 6th.
For some reason, I don't remember exactly what transpired, but I wasn't notified about how much of an extreme situation it was until it was just a few days before the operation that I find out how extreme it was from speaking to some of the people from Fish and Wildlife. And I believe Mary and I even had a few conversations about how it went downhill really quickly and what happened with Pat and the USDA veterinarians.
Because of what happened on May 6th, because the lows were not only attacking the agents and Pat Craig's team, they were threatening the agents' kids. And they made a lot of statements. And so when we went back for the second warrant.
Just to interject, Lauren Lowe was looking up everyone's families on social media, right?
Yeah. Based on how they interacted with the agents on May 6th, we took all of that information. You know, we had the lead agent put it in an affidavit. We presented it to the judge and we put that all out there for the judge and asked for additional requirements, additional sort of protections for that second operation, both in consultation with the marshals.
Right. You're responsible for everyone's safety, right, John?
Right. And I'm glad Mary brought that up. One of the things I also had to keep in mind were legal ramifications. So I knew once we set foot on the property, we need to have a continual presence to be able to keep the warrant going. Because otherwise, if we left, we'd have to seek another warrant. And so that was the other thing was I knew once we got started, Pat Craig and I believe there are 9 not-for-profit organizations that came out to assist, that we needed to keep them safe. We need to keep all the deputies safe. Jenny and her crew, the administrative side of the Marshal Service, the USDA vets, and the Lowe's. We need to keep the Lowe's and the other people that were on the property safe, and ultimately the animals. So I had to consider that and just the legal ramifications that once we set foot on that property within the guidelines of this warrant, we also couldn't leave until we fulfilled the warrant.
Mm-hmm.
Calling all lovers of mystery. Prepare to don your detective hat in June's Journey, a free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. Take a trip in time to the glitzy 20s and play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. The thrill is endless, with new chapters added weekly, allowing you to not only enjoy the detective adventure, but also to personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island, where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Was there a concern also that Jeff Lowe might release all the tigers from their cages?
Sure. Not necessarily just him. Any of the people out there that had access to these cages, I don't know them. I didn't know them. I don't know what they may or may not do. But leading up, as Mary pointed out, we'd pre-planned our operation and then they ended up doing theirs because they need to go in and get the cubs out
right.
just 11 days before. But I had that in the back of my head the entire time is not only are we going to be dealing with the individuals out there that I've watched these videos and the type of violence and threats of violence they could come up with is also just the fact that we're dealing with animals that in the wild take down buffalo and we're going to be out there as humans walking around. Yeah, we're armed, but these are major predators. And the fact that they could let the cages open and have the animals roaming free, the last thing any of us wanted to do was kill an animal.
Right.
We did not want to be out there and have to kill one of these cats.
Right.
So yeah, it was definitely a consideration.
Also, another consideration was the weather.
Oklahoma has the worst tornadoes in the world's history, as far as any kind of recorded history. We've had major tornadoes. And that's I like to call it the Oklahoma monsoon tornado season. And so between the heat and humidity, it's just the fact that you can have these major downpours or just tornadoes come out of nowhere. And day two, we saw the monsoon.
It was a muddy mess on day two. You know, another thing to note, like one of the things that Sean specialized in was making sure we had communications. We were in the middle of nowhere and a holler, basically. You had to go to the top of the hill just to get a cell phone signal. So there was a lot of operational logistics and planning to make sure that not only were we safe, but that we could also communicate to the outside world if we needed to.
Okay. So the morning of May 17th comes and you're now aware of how belligerent the Lowe's were on the 6th. How do you handle speaking with the Lowe's?
Operational brief the night before at one of the sheriff's offices in a border town in Texas. And that's where I had all the people meet us up, and I did the brief and set up the guidelines for not just the mission, but also the legal issues that we were serving a civil warrant. We weren't going to arrest people unless we had to, but within the confines of the warrant, we were there to effect a civil warrant to seize these animals. And so we took that in mind and laid out a plan, what time we would go. So the next morning we met up, the morning of, we went in a caravan of vehicles, and our special operations group bought some of their specialized vehicles with them. And so we had the caravan of vehicles, and Fish and Wildlife brought two agents. The rest of it, we took a small a contingency of SOG and the deputies. I would say it was at least 25 to 30 deputy marshals and agents that went, and the gates were open. So we were able to get into the approach, and that area of Oklahoma has a lot of sand. So there was a lot of issues once we got there that we were already warned that there's going to be a sandy issue and not the usual red clay of most of Oklahoma. So the sand getting in there, it wasn't really tricky with the bigger armored vehicles, but some of the vehicles had a little bit of issue getting in through the gate. And so we did our approach, spread the vehicles out, got out. And of course, everybody's armed. There was no pointing guns at anybody, but we were able to get up there and make our approach. I took the SOG commander, and he and I went to the front door. They had a trailer house that was within about probably 150 to 200 yards from the entry. And we went ahead and made our approach in the door, knocked and announced our presence. And Mr. Lowe and Mrs. Lowe, so Jeff and Lauren Lowe, came to the door. They had a small baby, I believe 2-year-old little girl. And I told Jeff Lowe I needed to talk to him, and that Lauren could stay there with the little girl. And brought Jeff down into a little area, probably about maybe 50 yards away from the trailer. Explained to him who I was, who the rest of us were, and why we were there. And I showed him a copy of the warrant, and I told him if he'd like, we can go ahead and read the warrant out loud. And so he read the warrant in its entirety.
His reaction was anger. It was complacent. What was his demeanor?
You know, contrary to what had happened, I guess about 10 to 11 days before, he said he completely understood and he would adhere to all the confines of the warrant.
Okay. And do you think that it had anything to do with the fact that you showed up with 30 agents that were armed?
Absolutely. Little different situation. I felt really bad for the people that went out there a little bit before us and everything they had to deal with. So he did take a look around, and he said, and I remember him saying, not a quote, but something to the effect that you guys aren't playing around. And he said, no, sir, we're not. And I asked him point blank if we're going to have any issues from here, from Warren. And he said, no, you won't. And he said, basically, they're going to stay inside. And I said, if you need me, here's who I am. Just reach out, have one of the deputies grab me, and I'll come talk to you. You're free to leave and come and go as you please, but I don't need you out interfering, and I don't need you obstructing. And I explained to him, too, that I was aware of what had happened the week before, and that wasn't going to happen today. And he said he understood.
Mm-hmm. And he wasn't supposed to have any firearms, right?
Yeah, I did some research before I went out there, checked his criminal history, and found that he's had a federal felony conviction. So according to federal law, correct, and even in Oklahoma law, he was not supposed to have any firearms.
And was that the case?
Yes. So during the search, the Fish and Wildlife agent and I did a search. We had to go into the residence, and we were searching. There's possibly them being cubs in there. And we also asked for our safety, if there are any weapons. And Jeff and Lauren both volunteered to us that there were some firearms between the mattresses and some other ones stored in one of the bedroom closets. And we did find some firearms on both sides of the bed, right, that Jeff and Lauren shared, stuff between the mattresses and in the closet.
Right. So it could have gone another way.
Sure.
Yeah. So I want to go to Valerie, and now you're going to evacuate over 60 cats. And you had alluded to earlier that the best thing that you can do is get the cats from their enclosure into the travel cage utilizing food.
That's correct. That's what we always try to do first. Right. In some situations, it's not possible. If, for example, you have, 10 cats in a small area, It's probably not going to be possible for you to individually load them into the cages. And that was the case in one of the enclosures there. And there are places where you can't sufficiently back up a cage to the entrance or exit from their enclosure so that you can safely allow a cat to walk into the cage from the enclosure. So there's some limitations on that. But in general, we always try to load them without sedation where possible. Right. But also there was me and two other veterinarians there, maybe more. I think the USDA had some vets there too. So we had plenty of trained veterinary medical staff to be able to safely sedate right. and monitor the animals that we had to.
And you had told me when we last talked that there are risks to sedating a healthy tiger.
That's correct. And that actually holds true for any animal. I'm not just right. talking tigers and lions here. There's a risk to sedation of any animal or human that gets sedated. Now, in particular with these animals, there's an extra risk because we don't know any of their medical history. We do know that they're malnourished. We do know that they've had no veterinary care. And so because of that, there's an additional risk to sedating these animals. They might not have perfect organ function due to the conditions they've been living under.
Right. And then the most extraordinary thing that happened on the operation was what happened when you sedated a cat and there were complications.
Yeah, that's true, Chris. So we had, you know, as I had mentioned before, these cats have very poor nutrition. We know nothing of their medical history, and a lot of them are hybrids. Now, hybrids are particularly sensitive to certain medications. And so we're always very careful when we sedate these cats. We always monitor them very closely after. So what happened was we had sedated a cat, moved her in the transfer cage. She was in the truck. The staff that was taking her was monitoring her. And I got a call that there was a cat that they were very worried about. She was breathing very shallow and they were concerned she wasn't going to make it. I was way out at the back at that time, ran back to the front to this cat. And indeed, she was taking very shallow breaths. She had had reversals. She should have been awake. So I ran back to the front where the loading area was immediately directed to this cat. And I could see that this cat indeed was taking very shallow breaths. She wasn't aware of anything going on. You could touch her, pinch her, and she wouldn't respond. And that was very concerning because she had gotten sedated and gotten reversals that should have reversed that sedation. So she should have, at the very least, been up moving around, even if she was still groggy. So I was very concerned about this cat. And because this sort of thing is something that happens, we have special kits already made up with emergency drugs and emergency medications. So I immediately started some fluids on this cat. I gave more reversals. I gave her medication to increase her heart rate. I gave her a medication to increase her respiratory rate. And it was touch and go for a little bit. But then she started to come around and responded to all of these treatments and started to wake up, which made everybody, I was breathing a little irregularly by that time too.
Wow.
We were able to take a breath. I knew that this cat would likely make it. But even so, we continued to monitor her throughout the day. We gave her additional medications and I was in constant contact with the team that was transporting her back to the sanctuary where she was going to live about the status of this cat over the next 24 uh-huh. hours.
Excellent. Well, congratulations. That's fantastic.
You. Yes.
So there was another dramatic event in which a cat was given a sedative and actually arrested. And the vet had to climb into the cage to start doing CPR. I did not know that you could do CPR on a tiger. Valerie, can you do CPR on a tiger?
Sure, you can do CPR on a tiger. It is more difficult because in order to get adequate chest compressions, you have to put a lot of force into it. They're huge animals. And so the point of giving these compressions is to force blood out of the heart and then to allow it to refill. And so in order to effectively give chest compressions in a large animal like a tiger, you have to put a significant amount of muscle into it.
And presumably the tiger is out of it, but if you're doing chest compressions, is there a danger that the tiger comes to and you're face to face.
Oh, absolutely. Whenever you're doing any type of CPR or resuscitation on an animal that's a dangerous animal, you always have to know where your escape route is and be watching for any signs of that animal coming up, because if it does, you need to get out of there immediately.
Right. And Sean, you were right there.
It was amazing. So I remember it was a smaller framed lady was on top of a massive tiger, and she's pushing, look what, all of her body weight up and down this tiger just to get its chest to move. And when the tiger started to come through, I walked up to whoever it was and I said something that was really, that was God's work, because I looked up and this tiger's opening its eyes, opening its mouth, starting to growl. And I was just really in awe of that going on.
Mm. And Valerie, you told me that it's really pretty unlikely that you're going to save a tiger by doing CPR.
Most of the time, if you lose a tiger, it is very rare to get them back. So I would say the reason this tiger survived was prompt intervention from multiple people. Mm-hmm. While that doctor was giving chest compressions, I was running back to get more reversals and other drugs. And it was a concerted effort among many people. We got fluids in there. We got reversals in there. We got CPR drugs in. And really, it was a miracle. It's very difficult. And I will say that with sedation, sometimes because you can reverse those drugs, you have a better chance at getting them back during CPR than under other circumstances.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But still, it is a very difficult task, and very the chance of success is low. So
Wow. It
truly was a great save.
Right. And just separately, I'm wondering, can you use paddles on a tiger or on animals?
Sure. We absolutely do use paddles to defibrillate animals. Uh-huh. The thing is, it's most often not indicated because animals don't get the same sort of cardiovascular disease as people do. And when people get cardiovascular disease from, arteries that are blocked and things like that, their hearts go into fibrillation. You can then use the paddles to defibrillate them. Generally in animals, the cause of cardiac arrest is not cardiovascular disease. And so they don't fibrillate. And so we use it much less in animals, but there certainly mm-hmm. are circumstances mm-hmm. where we do and right. where it is saves lives.
Okay.
Yeah. Chris, if I could add, I think one sort of really important thing that we haven't really sort of focused on is what I was told before this operation by Dr. Gage from USCA and others is that, typically if you're going to move something like 70 big cats, it happens over time. I've had USCA tell me we've taken months to remove that number of animals. And so there was an important point where we are trying to negotiate between, we can only take up, so much of the Marshall Service's resources. And my understanding, it's not common to have a multi-day warrant. And so we were thinking about, can it be done in 3 days? Can it be, we're trying to figure out what is the outer limit of how long this can take.
I've never seen it in my career. And even to now, I've been doing this almost 30 years. I've never seen a warrant start and then continue into another full day. It's unheard of. And that was one of the things I mentioned from the beginning is why I wanted that presence. We had to stay on site or otherwise I was going to be contacting Mary and saying, we're probably going to need to get another warrant. She's the attorney, but just me with my law enforcement knowledge and knowing about the laws, I really feel that we would have had to get another warrant once we vacated the site the first day. And so we stayed out there and they did an incredible job, especially day two. Day one, there were a lot of hiccups because of the sand. And there were a lot of issues with the front end loaders getting stuck because they were so big and the sand was just so easy to get sunk into. But day two, the rain just started coming down and never really stopped. So that was kudos to all the people that were able to get those tigers in safely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think it's worth mentioning. And first of all, Pat Craig needs a lot of credit. I have never seen a grown man talk to cats. I mean, it was just amazing. He had this little call and he kind of would take some raw meat and just talk to them. And it was like they knew him and they knew he was going to be nice to them and give them a great life. And they just followed him into their transport cages.
That's great.
But that second day, the ground was moving underneath us and everything was shifting. Everything was muddy. How are we going to get this heavy equipment back there? Because we had to make sure that the cages can come from the back all the way to the front where the transport vehicles were. And, you know, this, they didn't really care about the zoo. It certainly wasn't set up for foul weather and it had never been used for anything really. And the front entranceway had started to erode and these machines are just digging in the dirt. You know, think of like a four-wheeler just getting stuck and going nowhere. So we had to figure out, well, how are we going to get this heavy equipment back there? So there was groups of people that said, you know what, we need to move these logs. And we got an assembly line and move logs and built a little road so the heavy equipment could continue to get to the back where it needed to be. I mean, it was pretty amazing to see all of that action.
Right. Sean, we had talked a little bit and you said of all of your time in law enforcement, this operation may have taken the highest toll on you psychologically.
Yeah. So for several reasons, one is I think just a lot of maturity in my career. I'd seen a lot, and it seems like as a younger officer, even from officers I've talked to over the years, you're able to kind of pack things away and compartmentalize it in your mind and forget about things. And I've seen a lot in my years, but getting out there, and I'm also an animal guy, know a lot about animals, and have a lot of respect for things that these vets did. And I saw things and smelled things and encounter things that I never thought I'd encounter in my entire career. And also just on top of that, there's the amount of pressure that was put on me and Jenny to make this thing happen. It really kind of accumulated. It came to that day and then actually seeing these things firsthand. And I felt responsible for everybody out there, all the personal safety, like I said, even the Lowe's and the other people that are out there that worked with the Lowe's.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
So not only did I feel responsible for everybody, I also wanted to make sure Pat and his crew were not only safe, but were able to get those animals. I felt responsible for those animals as well. So just seeing the conditions of the animals and knowing what I knew about big cats, just from being interested in them, that in nature, they usually have, I think, up to like 60 square miles to roam. And they were in these enclosures that were like 4x8 slabs of concrete with some chain link fence around them and on top of them, completely exposed to the Oklahoma weather, which is extremely bad weather in winter and summer. The heat here gets well into the hundreds. And then the cold, like Mary spoke about earlier, had one of the worst winters on record there. Ice and snowstorms and winds, crazy windstorms. And just knowing these cats, not only were they exposed to this, I saw that they had fecal matter in their water sources. They'd have bones in there that were rotting and full of flies and maggots. And then as I walked through, I noticed that some of the cats had these really large enclosures, but they were putting them in two or three of them. And Pat alluded to this earlier. I saw some of the tigers actually fighting, and it wasn't a pretend fight. It wasn't a playful fight. They were actually fighting, and It's because one of them wanted to dominate the other one's cage area, I'm sure. And then I saw this mass, probably 20 to 30 feet high, and I realized what it was. It's carcasses. And I didn't see any big cat carcasses, but it was carcasses from what was probably people that lived in the area would bring their dead cattle or dead horses to feed the big cats. And they were poured with diesel fuel, and they weren't smoldering, but you could still smell the rotting flesh, the burned flesh, and the diesel. And then the swarms of flies was like something I would expect to see in a third world country.
Yeah, I can add to that. The visuals are something, you know, the smells and the sounds and seeing that trash pile of just bone. But it was just, you know, you walked around that place and it's just, these are just horrible people. And all, you know, what were they doing to monetize this and try? And I don't know how you could legitimately call yourself an animal lover or an animal person and do what they were doing. It was just, and you know, to be there three straight days with not a lot of sleep and being out in the weather and the rain, and it just really made you dislike them even more.
And Chris, the other thing is we've focused a lot on the 69 big cats that were rescued those 2 days. There were also wolves and cougars and lemurs and tortoises, some donkeys.
A camel. Yeah.
There's a menagerie of animals out there that I don't know what happened to them after either.
I can answer that.
Thank you, Mary.
So, so I think I mentioned earlier that we were really focused on compliance with the court order and getting paperwork, et cetera. And the judge was a no-nonsense judge who, you know, did not like people not complying with his court orders, and he was fining them on a daily basis. So we sort of had this pressure because they didn't have any interest in complying, and those fines were going up and up. And, you know, I know when all those cats were removed, I know it was so hard for the people on the ground because you never want to leave any animals behind. And the members of the public were really upset with us because they thought we were just taking the tigers because the tigers are cool, or the, you know, kind of the flashy animal, but it's what we had jurisdiction. I mean, they were endangered species, the tigers, the lions, the jaguar. We were using the forfeiture provision under the Endangered Species Act to remove those animals, but a camel is not an endangered species, and there's no forfeiture provision currently under the Animal Welfare Act. Oh. So I didn't actually have jurisdiction to seize and forfeit the rest of those animals. So right. We ended up having to use other, like, sort of pressures where, you know, to try to convince the Lowe's to give up the rest. And they actually did. So in August, I believe, they surrendered the rest of their animals, and those animals, including the camel, the cougars were, we convinced them to surrender much earlier. They were in bad condition. And during a court hearing, I mentioned to the judge, we have these two cougars that are really skinny and are not doing well, judge. You know, do you think we can ask the Lowe's on the record if they would be willing to give up those animals? And they did. And so we were able to get them out quickly. But the rest, it was right around mid-August when they gave up the rest.
Great. Pat, how do you travel big cats? Do you take them out and give them exercise? How often do you have to feed them? I mean, how hard is it to transport a big cat?
Well, yeah, it's not easy, but obviously, of doing this for four decades, we have a system, and our equipment and our trucks and trailers are air conditioned and have, you know, video systems in them. And so everything is customized to try and make it as comfortable as possible for the animals. But we do a straight through drive back so that the animals, whether they're going to our sanctuary or anybody else's, it's a matter of hours. It's not a matter of days or anything else to just get them to those destinations. And so we drive straight through the night if we need to, or whatever it is. And the good thing about these animals is they'll actually lay down and rest whenever there's motion. So instead of being in there and being nervous and pacing, they lay down and they kind of just go into a dormant mode, waiting to get to where it stops, and then they come back alive. So it helps them and it helps us, and there's less stress on the animals, and we can get there. So it's a good system, but it's taken, you know, a long time to come up with this and perfect it.
And how often do they have to eat? I mean, do they eat three times a day, or do you have to stop to feed them?
We do stop quite often to check on them and to water them and feed them. The vast majority of the time, the animals don't want to eat. They'll drink water, but they don't want to eat because, again, they're in this mode of let's wait and see where we're going and what's going to happen to us. So they're not necessarily starving at that point, even if they haven't been fed well before.
And so you got there. You had how many tigers?
We ended up rescuing 35 tigers from that operation, just from that major one in mid-May. Mm-hmm. But all told, you know, we had taken other tigers from Joe Exotic earlier and from Jeff Lowe, from those many things that Mary talked about. So, you know, all together, we took in over 147 animals from Tiger King people.
Right. And Mary, as we're wrapping up, there's one big question that has yet to be answered. Why aren't Jeff and Lauren Lowe behind bars?
Well, Chris, first of all, I'm not a prosecutor. I'm a civil attorney. What I could do and what I have the authority to do is to permanently enjoin Jeff and Lauren from operating their zoo, and we could remove the animals.
Right.
So on the civil side, we did everything that we could.
10 out of 10, grand slam. You got the cats and you got them to a better place. So job well done. And obviously it's not your job to bring criminal charges. So whose job is it? And why haven't they been brought? Several tigers died because of their neglect. So it would seem like, you know what? We could make some space in a facility for people like them.
No, I appreciate the question, Chris. So generally, a criminal case needs to be brought by a prosecutor, and you have to have a law that authorizes charges for animal cruelty and neglect, which is what you're talking about. There, as a general matter, there does not exist a federal law that prohibits animal neglect and cruelty. Those types of crimes are typically handled at the state level. However, there are a lot of limitations even then. Depends on the state, depends on the species of animals. So
What does that mean in terms of species of animal?
So for instance, you know, I would say every state has animal neglect regulations for cats and dogs, the normal small pets.
Okay.
But many do not have any laws or limited laws that prohibit neglect or cruelty as to wild or exotic animals. There are also almost no protections for farmed animals. So many animals that are in the United States are actually not protected, or very minimally are protected by federal or state law.
And so I can't obviously assume an animal is an animal is an animal?
No, it definitely depends on the type of animal. So in this case, to my knowledge, there wasn't a state law that would address neglect or cruelty to tigers.
Wow.
And even at the federal level, you know, if you're looking at the Endangered Species Act, which is the only federal statute that maybe could address that issue, even then, at best, it's a misdemeanor, which often does not, you know, even if you prove up the government the case.
Time out for one moment. So what you're telling me is everything that we have heard, everything the Lowe's have done in terms of their neglect on a federal level, the most you could do is charge them with a misdemeanor?
Correct. In terms of their treatment of the animals, that is correct.
That seems ludicrous on so many levels.
Chris, I don't make the laws.
Okay. All right. Look, I'm glad that we're getting that information out, because that's seems like something that should be changed. And obviously, I now understand why you don't take the resources and go after somebody on a federal level. And the best you can do is to take the animals, but there's no real deterrence for them to do it again.
So on the federal level, the result in the civil case was that they can no longer engage in exhibition of animals, like any activity that requires an Animal Welfare Act license, they are permanently prohibited from engaging in that activity. So there is deterrence, and the deterrence is you can't open up another zoo.
Right. Okay. And on the state level in Oklahoma, as far as you know, did Oklahoma go after them at all?
I'm not aware of any state level prosecutions of Jeff and Lauren.
Well, I guess that's the bittersweet ending of this story, is that you hit a grand slam and took the Tigers and got them to a better place, but they're not paying as high a price as I think, and probably most reasonable people would believe that they should pay for their negligence. Okay. Yes, I understand that given your position, that that's about as good an answer as I'm going to get.
Yeah.
Silence. That's okay. Thank you very much for explaining that.
Of course.
With that, I want to thank my guest for sharing the story of this incredible rescue operation. You persevered and saved many tigers in the process. Mary Hollingsworth, a senior trial attorney with the Department of Justice's Environment and Natural Resources Division. Jenny Crane, assistant chief of the Asset Forfeiture Division at the U.S. Marshal Service. Sean Zwerab, retired assistant chief inspector at the U.S. Marshal Service. Dr. Valerie Johnson, head vet at the Wild Animal Sanctuary and an assistant professor at Michigan State University. And finally, Pat Craig, founder and executive director of the Wild Animal Sanctuary. Pat, we're going to just take a second. Tell us a little bit about the sanctuary and how people can support the great work that's being done there.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. I mean, everybody there, as you've heard today, everybody had a huge part in this whole operation. And, you know, thank God that the DOJ even intervened, because these people were, you know, between all the different characters, were cranking out hundreds of baby tigers and lions a year. And so those were going into the stream and then eventually would end up at the sanctuary, our sanctuary, or somebody else's, because obviously these are not pets and they don't end up, you know, being anything that people can keep other than in a proper setting. So, but, you know, we we worked diligently to do this, and our sanctuary is by far the largest sanctuary in the country for lions and tigers. You know, we have almost 500 lions, tigers, bears, wolves, leopards, mountain lions. So we took in wolves from the lows, as well as many other things. We took, you know, like the camel and other animals from there. And you can learn more about it at wildanimalsanctuary.org or just wildanimalsanctuary.org. Either way, you know, the sanctuary feeds over 100,000 pounds of food a week to these animals. So it's not a small operation by any means. And we have over 100 employees and 160 volunteers to take care of these animals. We constantly go on rescues, not only here in the country, but internationally, and address this problem, you know, all over the world now. So if people want to learn more, then go to our website, and hopefully if you want to support it, it'd be great.
Thanks very much, Pat. Please, please, please subscribe, write a review, give us a 5-star rating, and spread the word. We need your help. And finally, Chasing Evil is produced with the cooperation of the United States Marshal Service. It contains interviews with current and retired employees, as well as other persons. Opinions, positions, and views expressed by any of them may not reflect the official views, positions, or policies of the United States Marshal Service. Stay safe, everyone.